Hi, this is Sukyun Lee, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
Segment of our show, Selena Britton and Abby Gruff will be telling us a little bit about the CHD3 Foundation. So if you could introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about the foundation, that'd be
sure. My name is Abby, and I'm on the board for the CHD3 Foundation, and I have a daughter who is 9 years old who has Snyder's Block Kampoa syndrome.
For those who might not be as familiar, could you take me through a little bit of how the syndrome impacts?
Sure. Selena, do you want to introduce yourself first, and then we can do that?
Yeah. So my name is Selena Britton. I, too, am on the board for the CHD3 Foundation, and my daughter is also 9 and has Snyder's Block Kampoa syndrome.
How exactly does the syndrome impact a person?
Yeah, so Snyder's Block Kampoa syndrome is a mutation of the CHD3 gene. There's various things that it affects, but developmental delays, intellectual disabilities. A lot of people were kind of found because they had speech impairments. Do you have anything to add, Selena?
So basically, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Abby, it was barely found in 2018. So it's a fairly new disorder. So there's still research being done. At the point that, like, Abby, myself, and some of the other moms that are on the board found out that our kids had this disorder, it's all of the symptoms are kind of different. Because of this gene, it affects all areas of development. And so far, it's my understanding, every child that we know of so far has a different mutation. So every case looks slightly different. But it essentially affects all areas of development. Causes speech and motor delays, learning differences, autism-related behavior, and physical impairments as well. So it's kind of a wide range of disability that it affects.
So that being said, with the host of symptoms, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis?
Absolutely. I think so. Initially, like for me, my daughter did not get a diagnosis until she was 3, and I knew from the get-go that something was wrong. And I hate to say wrong, because in my eyes, like, our kids are perfect, you know, that's how God made them. It's just different, I should say. And doctors were kind of like, you know, kids learn differently, kids go at their own pace, and initially, my child was just labeled as autistic. She didn't talk at, you know, your typical time frame of talking. We just did sign language for the first few years of life. And that was kind of it. And I really had to push to get testing done. And it was several rounds of genetic testing before they caught it. And like I said, it was barely found in 2018. She was born in 2017. And so it was a few years until we actually got the diagnosis. And at that point, the geneticist that actually called us had never even heard of the disorder at that point.
Right. Yeah, we found out in 2018 as well. And we found out along with, like, Jerianne, who's on our board as well, her son was 18, and she was finding out at the same time. So it's very, very new. And I guess, like, the first diagnosis we got were kind of, I don't know what the right word is for this, but, like, she got, like, speech delay and visual impairment and a lot of diagnoses that were just based on like what we were seeing, but we didn't know what was causing it.
So for each of you, being parents of children with this disorder, how did you keep yourself strong through those just trying to slough it off sort of diagnoses?
Yeah, for me, it was really hard her first like year or two when I didn't know, are we going to catch up, you know, or are we going to, that was kind of the unknown was hardest for me, I guess. And we did a lot of therapy. We had a lot of doctor's appointments. So it was really hard for me because I was watching her get kind of poked and prodded when she was just so little. So, those first couple of years were really hard for me that way, but my daughter is a really, really happy and affectionate little girl, and so, I mean, it was so much fun, too, you know, with her growing up, but yeah, there was a lot of struggles with that, too.
Yeah, so for me, I'm a teacher, and I was actually teaching first grade at the time. Oh, my lights, I'm sorry, I have motion-sensitive lights in my classroom. So with my daughter, I kind of went into teacher mode. She wasn't hitting her milestones, and so I knew how important early intervention was. I kind of felt like our pediatrician was blowing us off a little bit. And, you know, I don't want to blame him saying he's blowing us off. I just think he was thinking, you know, every kid learns differently. It's still early. And so I just reached out to diagnosticians and things within our school district and said, what do you suggest? Who do we go to? So, I mean, I guess to answer your question, it takes a village, a lot of support from different people, continuing to ask questions and not really stopping until you get an answer, and just really relying on family and friends who can support you and be there when you're crying and trying to figure it out and just not giving up.
So with the diagnosis having first been discovered only a few years ago, do you happen to know how many people are potentially affected?
Oh, gosh. Do you remember how many it is?
Yeah, I wrote it down, actually. I checked right before. So as of right now, there are 237 known cases worldwide.
So with the foundation's inception since 2018 and the work you've been doing, has there been any success moment or story you've experienced that you'd like to share?
Do you want to go, Abby?
I don't have anything that's coming to my mind, so if you have something, go ahead.
Well, so for me, and I think I can speak for all of us when I say, like, it really blows my mind what some strong moms can do. And it started with moms. I'm not sure. I don't know if you know, Abby, who started the Facebook page.
So that was Emily. And then I was the second person to join.
Okay. So
yeah.
I would say you two were absolutely the most crucial in all of this. Because when I first got the diagnosis, I immediately, you know, got online before the geneticist had even called me. Like, I just opened my daughter's portal when the results came in, saw the diagnosis, and had already read everything there was on the internet to find before the geneticist even called. And at that point, I found the Facebook page. And that gave me so much hope, seeing that there are other people who are going through this. And it was the same stories. It was like the same things, the same struggles in pregnancies, the same delays. And just having that feeling of not feeling alone was a huge weight lifted off of us, for my family, for me. And that's kind of where it blew up from there. So I feel like Emily and Abby like had the biggest hand in all of that, getting that going and bringing awareness. And then it was just a group of moms who were like, okay, we need to take it a step further. Now this Facebook page has grown. Now we've got people who are fighting for answers and fighting for questions, you know, getting more out there, researched. And so then we were like, hey, we should start a foundation. And we really didn't know where to start. Honestly, again, I just got on Facebook and was like, hey, we're looking to start a foundation, but our issue is that we are not only nationwide, but we're worldwide. So how do we do that with the legalities of everything? And a friend of a friend reached out and said, hey, I'm an attorney and we can help you pro bono. So that's kind of where it all went from there. I mean, everything really just fell into place, and it's taken a village of people who have come together to make this foundation happen and really raise awareness. Dr. Campeau has been phenomenal. He's been a huge support in our foundation. And I just think the momentum that we're finally gaining with all of this is something to really highlight. And I think it's strong moms. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, the family connection is probably our biggest success, because it's not that we've done a ton yet. We're still trying to raise a lot of funds and kind of brainstorm what we want to do, how we want to bring awareness, how we want to help with research, how we want to do all these things. But the biggest thing, I think, is supporting families and for people to go to other families and say, hey, this is what we're experiencing. Does anybody else have this going on? And people can really reach out and support each other.
And you know what I think is really cool about that, too, is during COVID, that was really hard for me personally, because I didn't know how, you know, this could potentially affect our children. We really stayed at home. And I ended up connecting with a mom in Brazil through the Facebook page.
Yeah.
Who, too, was, like, stuck at home, really scared. And Facebook translates everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so we became really close and were able to talk through COVID and checked in every single day on each other and still kind of check in. And I just think that community aspect of it is really what helps us thrive, truthfully.
Well, yeah.
I thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you. Absolutely.
In this segment of our show, Shelley Redman will be telling us a little bit about the Huntington Society. So what can you tell me about the work of the Society?
Okay.
Okay. Whenever you're ready.
Okay. Thanks so much, Cam. I thought before delving into the work of HSC, it's important for listeners to understand and be aware of what Huntington disease is. So HD, Huntington disease, is a rare neurodegenerative disease that affects one in every 7,000 Canadians, and approximately one in every 5,500 is at risk for developing the disease. And I think it's also really important to recognize that there's many, many more people that are touched by HD, either as a caregiver, a family member, or a friend. And so each child of a parent with HD has a 50% chance of developing the disease. It usually occurs in between the ages of about 35 to 55, but it can occur in older adults, and about 10% of all HD cases are diagnosed before the age of 20. Those are called juvenile HD presentations, and they usually tend to progress faster. So HD is often described as having elements of Parkinson's, ALS, Alzheimer's, and schizophrenia all at the same time. And we currently have no medications that stop or slow the progression of HD.
So is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis given the host of symptoms?
So, it's easy to diagnose because, we're one of the few neurodegenerative disease that we know the cause. They can do the genetic testing and know whether you're carrying the gene for it. So misdiagnosis often happens where there isn't specialist care with a neurologist that is, neurology in particular, but especially those that are specialists in HD or movement disorder care. If it is new to the family and they weren't aware of any previous family members affected, there may be many, many years where they don't think of HD as a possibility and go down that genetic testing route.
So how does the Society reach out to those who could potentially benefit from their work? And can you give me a bit of an overview of what you folks do to provide support?
For sure. So we have social workers and psychotherapists and a child and youth practitioner that provides support clear across Canada, with the exception of Quebec. We have a sister organization in Quebec that we work alongside. So they provide support for individuals and families affected by HD. So While they don't quote and solicit, certainly our movement disorder clinics provide the information that HSC is there to provide support whenever and however somebody is needing it. We also have, our general phone line, and we have a special intake section on our website called ADME, where somebody, maybe they're just having a question and they don't want to become a client of ours, that they might prefer to just ask anonymously, ask a question or some support, provide some support. But we're there for anybody in the community or anybody who, whether they're living with HD or they're a carer, a spouse, a family member. And then we also provide support to the healthcare community, so and our emergency services, so our family services, social workers, and team members will go out to the community if the police service is struggling with somebody that's affected with HD and we could use some support. We have specialized support for emergency services. They'll also do in services in long-term care homes and in hospitals where somebody might be housed at the time with HD, and it's not something that they have been familiar with.
So in your time with the society, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Successes. We've had so many successes over the years. I think, one of our successes is our ability to increase our social work reach year over year. So we have increased our funding and hours for social workers. Is it enough? Never enough. If we could have twice as many social workers, family service team members out in the community, that would be fabulous. But I think, the work that they do, a huge success is around the awareness of HD. Advocacy, both, political advocacy, with the boots on the ground with the family services team is another huge success. And I think the biggest success, and it's not our success, it's a global success, is the developments in HD research over the last number of years. We're seeing so many more people get into the space. And our own research funding program, we started it in 2003, and we've funded over $7.5 million in research funding. So we've provided funding for 37 research awards across 16 institutions in 7 provinces since 2003. And we continue to branch and develop our research offerings, both at the postdoc level when they're entered the field, as well as we're targeting people at the baccalaureate level, so we can get more interest in the field early on.
Like to thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Disability Studies Students Association is a small and tight-knit community of people who are passionate about and committed to representing and supporting disability studies students at the University of Windsor. The DSSA holds events on campus and in the community, like the annual Down Syndrome Day Walk, to raise funds for supporting organizations. If you would like to get involved or learn more, you can contact the Disability Studies Student Association directly at dssa@uwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Selena Britton and Abby Groth told us a little bit about the CHD3 Foundation, and we heard a little bit about the Huntington Society from Shelley Redmond. In this segment of our show, Donna Jodan will be telling us a little bit about her disability story.
So what can you tell me about your disability story?
I am vision impaired. I have been an advocate for decades. I have the dubious reputation of having taken the Canadian government to court over their inaccessible websites. and I was successful in my legal challenge. It was a charter challenge. And I also have the, in 2015, I led a campaign to convince the government of the day to enact the Accessible Canada Act, which was enacted in 2019. I have my fingers in quite a few different pies. I truly believe that my work is all about making a better future for our kids. And this is what I continue to do through my own podcasts and through my other initiatives.
So when you filed suit against the Canadian government, what were some of the barriers on the website that made it inaccessible?
A lot of the fields were not accurately or properly or appropriately labeled. So like, for example, like the date field in most forms, whenever you entered the date, it was very difficult to enter said date because, you know, you should enter something in YYMMDD. Not should, but in most cases, that's how it needs to be done. But in order for a vision impaired person to be able to do that, they really had to work at finding the appropriate number in order to enter it into the date field. In addition to which, graphics were not properly labeled. Forms were not properly, the fields and forms were not properly labeled. So it was awfully difficult to complete online forms. Those were some of the major drawbacks for inaccessible websites on the government's part.
So, in pushing for change, how did you keep yourself strong in moments when it might have seemed discouraging or a big task taking the government to accountability?
I think for me it was believing that what I was doing would benefit blind and vision impaired Canadians as a whole, surrounding myself with like-minded people. I'm not saying it was easy. It was not easy, but it was not for the faint of heart. And, you know, having faith and having, you know, believing in myself and praying very hard that what I was doing was the right thing.
So, that being said, since your push, is there any success moment or story that came from all this you'd like to share?
I'm not sure how, if I can ask you to clarify. You said successful story.
Just anything that you've pushed for that's really come to fruition, or anything in your work that you've seen progress on.
I think it's easier in many ways when I push for something that you see success in, that you are included in roundtables or that you are included in committees, but it doesn't necessarily mean that success stops there. You know, you have to go forth and make sure that what you're saying, people are listening, not just including you on a committee or on a round table or in a round table because they have to. It's all about collaboration or engagement and collaboration. There's really no real story to success with anything as far as I'm concerned. Success is how you measure it. And I would say that some days you look at this and you say, it has been successful. Other days you look at it and you say, well, I don't really think so. There's more work to be done.
So if you could see anything added to what's available for the blind and visually impaired community, what would it be?
Now, when you say something added, do you mean, can you tell me me a bit more?
In terms of available services, resources, just something
a little bit more equal.
Um, the types of services are more accessible in that, you know, when you go to do certain things, it is easier to do. Like, it's easier to get support, it's easier to get help to complete forms online. However, there's a very interesting thing going on right now with the 2026 Statistics Canada census. And, you know, you receive a form in your mailbox, but the form for a blind person, a vision impaired person, is difficult. We can't read it. I cannot read it. I need help to have that form read to me. If I choose to go online and do, you know, the survey or the census, I have to get someone to give me that QR code by reading it from the form that I have received. And if I choose to do it online, which I have not chosen to do, because I think I'd rather do it by phone, then I'm stuck to a certain point. And what's happening right now is that persons who are blind, vision impaired, are asking, where's the phone number? Who do we call? And I can tell you that by their ads on television, if there is a phone number to call, I don't know what it is because they're not telling us what it is. It may be on screen, but they're not telling us. So again, you know, you go forward by two steps, maybe you go back by one step. Services are accessible to a certain extent, but there's a lot more to be done. Accessible voting has come a long way, but still there is more work to be done. So, you know, when you look at success, you say to yourself, what is success? Does it mean we've progressed by steps, or does it mean it's just a little bit at a time?
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Of course. I must say, my friends, I admire Donna's strength of will. It can be a very difficult thing to take to task any government agency, but the fact of the matter is, governments need to be accountable to their people. If something's inaccessible, it is by definition unfair. And expecting someone to be able to participate fully in any voting democratic process is just unreasonable if a person with a disability doesn't have the tools they need to do it confidentially and with equality. That is by no means to say that anything will ever be fully accessible, for one person's definition of accessible can differ widely from another's. It's not a matter of getting things perfect. It is a matter of taking steps in that direction to see how much progress we can make. But you cannot get to accessibility unless you listen to the needs of individuals with disabilities. You just can't do it. Telling them what they want is ultimately self-defeating and fosters resentment. Listening to what they want makes them feel validated, understood, accepted, and even encourages participation in processes of the community. For the truth of the matter is, a person with a disability has no less right to be counted as part of a census or to vote independently than anyone else. But are we giving them the resources and the opportunities to make this happen? It's the question that must always be on our minds, folks. It's accessible to me, but is it accessible to you? Are we, as a community, and as representatives, doing all we can for the disability population? Yeah, it might require overhauling a few in-place systems, but honestly, once the work is done, you'll find the turnout and the participation is so much better. And that is a step in the direction of equality. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
How much do you love this station? People dedicated to your community. News that directly matters to you. This station needs your support. Go to mycri.ca to find out more about the Community Radio Initiative, which will provide core funding for this station. At MyCRI, you will find an easy way to create an email that you can send to the politicians who need to hear your message. Just 5 minutes and a few clicks make a big difference. MyCRI.ca.
Hi, my name is Taku. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons.